Good evening. Good evening. Welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Carol Malone, Chair of the Board of Trustees. Thank you for coming out on what I think must be the coldest night of the year to join us this evening to hear Michael Schneerson. As we begin, a couple of points of business. If you would silence your cell phones and any devices, that would be helpful in having an uninterrupted presentation. And we're glad to have books for sale outside this room in the Peluso Family Exhibition Gallery. Our friends from the Corner Bookstore will be selling those after the lecture. A brief mention that everything we do here, from lectures to our children's activities to our performances, often in this room, to our book buying and maintaining our beautiful building, depends on the support of our donors. The subscriptions that you pay only cover about 23% of our operating expenses. So anything that you would like to, any form you'd like to support the library, we would love you to join us in that effort, and you can speak to any of the staff members about that. When we moved to this building on East 79th Street in 1937, we didn't know that we were going to be next to what was to become Museum Mile. Although the Metropolitan Museum arrived at its first uptown home in 1880, the Guggenheim was downtown for many years, and it wasn't until 1953 that it actually moved to a townhouse in this neighborhood on East 72nd Street before, of course, moving in 1959 to the Frank Lloyd Wright Building. The Frick had just opened to the public in 1937. But the arts have always been important to the members of this library. And for example, in the 1870s, about 150 years ago, a member, John Cleve Green, left a generous bequest to the library for the purchase and repair of art books, which is why we still have an alcove upstairs in Stack 12 called the Green Alcove. And if you work here and don't know about it, I suggest you find out about it. It's a very large, spacious area with a wonderful chair and desk. And if you're first to arrive, you can use it for the rest of the day. And we're always honored when an author tells us that the library has helped them write their new book, which is why we're additionally delighted to have Michael Schneerson here this evening. He is a longtime contributing editor to Vanity Fair, the author of 8 books on a range of nonfiction subjects, from My Song, the biography of entertainer Harry Belafonte, The Contender, about Andrew Cuomo, to The Killer Within, a narrative-driven account of drug-resistant bacteria, and Coal River, about the mountaintop coal removal. His latest book, Boom, Mad Money, Mega Dealers, and the Rise of Contemporary Art, has been called a sparkling, high-octane account by Stacey Schiff, another author who is a library member. Daniel Weiss, the president and CEO of the Metropolitan Museum, has said, Boom reflects better than anything I have read the characters, the motives, and the overall vibe of the contemporary art world. Of course, this neighborhood now is full of vibrant galleries, auction houses, and museums. So you're in a long tradition here. Please join me in welcoming Michael Schneerson.
Hi there, good evening. And thank you for coming out on this cold night. I'm thrilled to be talking here. The New York Society Library really has a special place in my heart. Like most writers, I've been between books, and this is a wonderful place to come up and fiddle around at the writers' desks and try to figure out what your next book is. And I've done that. Anyway, I wrote this book about contemporary art and sort of where it came from, and more to the point, how it went from being this little circle of Greenwich Village dealers and artists to this global bonanza that we have. And it's an interesting day to be talking about this because just today, amazing news came from the art world that the $450 million collection of the late Don Marin is going to be sold by a consortium of dealers. This is really unusual. Usually, a huge collection like this goes to Sotheby's or Christie's. I mean, and so there must be enormous cackling going on among these guys for having pried it away from the auction houses. And it's also kind of interesting. They're fierce rivals. They would kill each other if they could. But they're also rather charming. And so that is Arnie Blimsher. And he, very spry in his early 80s, he plays a very important part in my book, goes back almost to the start of the story. That's Bill Aquavella, also a long-standing dealer, actually second generation, and we'll talk a little bit about him. Wonderful man, very elegant. And there is the notorious Larry Gagosian. That, by the way, is Mark Glimcher, son of Arnie. So keep these guys in mind because they are part of the story. My story really begins right after the war. I knew I was interested in contemporary art of that period. I mean, that's really where the phrase contemporary art, applies. And, of course, that means abstract expressionist art. And it meant, as it turned out, a number of dealers who were excited enough about this art to want to represent these struggling artists and try to push them to prominence. And Peggy Guggenheim had been in the States on 57th Street during the war. As some of you may know, she came bearing all this art that she had bought up from artists in Europe, who, with the Nazis breathing down their necks. And she, in particular, was taken by this artist, Jackson Pollock. And so she had a lot of his stuff. She didn't like it that she couldn't sell it very well, though other people hadn't yet caught on to Pollock. So by the end of the war, she decided she was fed up. She was going to go back to Venice, where she'd come from. And she basically gave all her artwork to another dealer, another sort of up-and-coming dealer named Betty Parsons. And let's see if we can have a... Oh, wait a minute. No, you're not going to get Betty Parsons. Betty Parsons, a much-adored dealer in her day who, at one point in about 1948, represented what she called her four horsemen, which was Pollock... Clifford Still and Barnett Newman and Mark Rothko. Just down the hall in the same gallery was another dealer named Sidney Janis. Betty Parsons actually rented him that space. She had the whole space. And to her fury, Jackson Pollock's wife, Lee Krasner, decided that Betty wasn't doing enough to sell her husband's work, and she took him down the hall to Sidney. So Sidney, who is in the background there, that's of course de Kooning. De Kooning came directly to Sidney Janis, didn't come by way of Betty Parsons. Everybody regarded Sidney Janis as sort of the smart financial guy of this world of entirely impecunious artists and dealers, because he had invented the two-pocket shirt. Now, the two-pocket shirt was something that was very helpful if you were a man in the South and it was really hot, because you could doff your jacket and you could stick all your pens and pencils and stuff in this second pocket. So he made a fortune. And with that, he stopped working in the garment district and became an art dealer and was de Kooning's dealer. but these are only a prelude to the most significant dealer of the late 50s, 60s, and on, Leo Castelli, of course. Leo is great fun to learn about, write about. He was born in Trieste. His family was Jewish, so when the war threatened, he was fortunate enough to get out with his wife, Ileana, and to come with, indeed, his in-laws to New York. As it happened, Leo, a very graceful guy who spoke five languages, had the good sense to marry a very wealthy woman whose father was wealthy enough to just buy them all a townhouse at 4 East 77th when they came over to New York. And for some years, Leo didn't really have too much to do in a formal way with art. He was what you would call, in the best sense, a dilettante. He had time on his hands, lunch breaks, weekends. He would go down and he'd schmooze with the dealers and the artists. But he didn't think he could become a dealer himself. Except little by little, being encouraged by Sidney Janis and others, he decided, okay, he would. And he all he needed to start a gallery was a couple of artists, because he had his father-in-law's townhouse to use as a gallery. He found one in Robert Rauschenberg, who's, you know, sort of combines, as they were called, combining these various pieces and things, much of it found on the streets, had begun to interest people. And so he scooped up Rauschenberg and Jasper Johns, and that became his first great chapter. In fact, there was such excitement about Jasper Johns' first show at the nascent Leo Castelli Gallery that there was enormous competition for who would buy all the paintings. I mean, they were sold out very quickly, and one of the most rapacious buyers was Alfred Barr, of the director of MoMA. And it got down to one more painting that looked kind of like this. Alfred Barr realized, however, that when he opened one of, there were like little hinge doors. And when he opened one, there was a penis in it. I mean, obviously not a real penis, mind you, but a a wooden constructed penis. And so he said to Jasper, "Would you mind if I do buy this painting for the museum, if we kept that door closed?" And Jasper said, "Well, how often would it be closed?" And Barr said, "Well, I think most of the time." And so, regretfully, Johns sold it back to Castelli, I think it was, or maybe it was Philip Johnson. At any rate, that was the beginning. This is, that just happens to be one of my favorite pictures from this whole era. Irving Blum, very dapper guy who became the first to sort of discover Andy Warhol for a West Coast audience. And he also, he sold a lot of Jasper Johns stuff. He was always trying to get Jasper Johns to sell him a famous bronze Savarin can, you know, with paintbrushes coming out of it. And every year he would call Johns and ask if he was finally ready to sell Blum this beautiful bronze artwork. And Johns would say with great regret, "No, I'm sorry, I don't think this year." And so finally Blum said, "You're not ever going to sell me this piece, are you?" And he said, "No, but I like hearing your voice." So anyway, he was a matinee guy. He's still going strong, Irving Blum. I had lunch with him the other day. Now, this gets us to one of the people in the picture I showed you. This is Arnie Glimcher at about age 20. And he's a fascinating person from the start. He grew up in the Midwest on a ranch. His mother decided he needed an infusion of art, so she moved the whole family to Boston. He studied art. He actually, like a lot of dealers, he thought he would be an artist. This is something you find again and again with dealers. They reach a point where they realize they aren't meant to be dealers, or they're just not quite as good. In the case of Arnie, he went to an art school in Boston where another student was Bryce Marden. Who is, as most of you may know, one of the leading abstract painters of our time now, just turned 90. And Arnie thought he was a pretty good artist, but he knew he wasn't as good as Bruce Martin. So instead, he decided he would become a dealer. He was up there in Boston, and had the tragedy of having his father, whose name was Pace, die prematurely. And the family was walking up Newbury Street in Boston, perhaps just coming from the synagogue. And Arnie's older brother said, well, so what are you going to do? And Arnie said, well, there's an open storefront there. I've always liked art. Maybe I should start a gallery. And the older son said, yes, we'll do that. We'll give you the money, and you'll do that. So he started up there. He had no particular artist. He had no artist. What he did rather cleverly is get all the art teachers from his college to contribute their art, because they were all really bad, and they were delighted to have their art on the walls. And so that worked for a little while, and then he got to know Louise Nevelson. There's Louise Nevelson constructing one of her wonderful black boxes or whatever, you know, sculptured boxes. And she was induced to come to Boston, put on a show at his little teeny gallery at 125 Newbury Street. And they really became very close. She was sort of like a surrogate mother to him. And she was a very emotional woman who was actually represented by Sidney Janis of the Two Pocket Shirts, but she was very angry at Sidney because Sidney had locked up all her work in a warehouse. He didn't want her to what he really wanted was for her to do more work, and she wouldn't do it until... she wouldn't do it until she could get her art back. So they were tussling over this, and she said, Arnie, I don't know what I'm going to do. That awful man has just kept my work locked up. And Arnie said, I will save you. And he sold what little art he had by well-known artists, and he raised money and whatnot, and he gave her $20,000. And as a result, she became one of his artists. This is a gorgeous woman who is a fabulous dealer of minimalist art. And this was something that was going on in the 60s, even as Castelli and then Arnie were paving their way. We'll get to that. at any rate, Arnie realized that he had to come down to New York. He was never going to get anywhere if he was a dealer in Boston. So he came down, he rented a little gallery space on 57th Street with his wife, Millie, who is still his wife, like, I don't know, 60 years later. They have a wonderful marriage. Arnie was very disconsolate. The more he looked at the art scene in New York, the more depressed he became, because he could see that Castelli had gotten there first. He had signed up Roy Lichtenstein and James Rosenquist and Frank Stella and Warhol and a few others, Claes Oldenburg, and some, not all of them, but some kind of fit into a category you could call pop art, and it was immensely popular. Arnie was reduced to being a kind of, as he said later, I mean, he was exaggerating, but he felt that he had to kind of pick up the scraps, you know. So the artists that he began to collect had nothing in common with each other, which made it interesting, but challenging. so, all right, these guys, Arnie and Castelli, became the dominant dealers of the 60s, I would say. I mean, others came along too, but I'm trying to keep this moving along. By the 70s, a couple of very contradictory things happened. One was that there was a famous auction held. The taxi magnate Robert Scull and his wife had this auction, which I'm sure many of you do know about, in which all the art, art sold by all those artists from the late 50s, 60s, Jasper Johns, Rauschenberg, Warhol, they did enormously well, and everybody realized, my God, contemporary art is very lucrative, and so that sort of changed the game. But at the same time, only a year or two later, the mid-70s recession set in, and for several years, not much was going on in contemporary art. Something new was needed, and something new came along in the person of one Larry Gagosian, whose picture you saw earlier. And Larry is a fascinating guy because, unlike most dealers, he didn't come from money. He was a lower middle class kid from the Fresno area of California, which was to say from the Armenian area. He lived amid Armenians on every side, every possible relation. And he went to USC. He had no art in his life up to that point. He remembered his mother having one little thing on the wall, some watercolor. No one talked about art at his home. He didn't study art in college. And after college, he thought, well, I'll just, get the kind of job you get out here in L.A. I'll work for the William Morris mailroom. And so he did, and one of the people that he worked for was Mike Ovitz, the famous agent, whom Larry disliked, and so he quit the William Morris company, which is something very few people do. And he got a job in a record store. He got a job in a grocery store. He was basically, through his 20s, going nowhere. And so when he was about 30, he got another job as a parking garage manager. This was a step up. And he noticed every day when he was at the parking lot, a guy down the street parking his car, opening his trunk, and taking out these posters and unfurling them and selling them to whoever went by. And maybe each poster only got about 10 bucks, but they only cost a few. So Larry thought, I could do that too. And he went to the very same poster company from which this other guy had gotten his posters. And he started with, those sort of treacly posters with cats with big eyes. But then he moved up a little bit and sort of classic, reproductions. And before you knew it, he had a framing store in the area where he framed these things, which he realized could net him more money. And this was pretty much Larry Gagosian. As he went to New York to figure out what this whole New York art scene was about. And he wasn't a dealer. He didn't have a gallery. He did have a connection. He had a connection who actually is an old friend of mine, a guy named Ralph Gibson, who's a photographer. Larry, out in California at his frame shop, had been thumbing through an arts magazine one day and seen pictures, photographs by this guy, Ralph Gibson. They're pretty cool, pretty sexy. And he called Ralph and said, could he represent Ralph at his new framing store, which he was kind of segueing into being a gallery. And Ralph said, well, yeah, but I've never heard of you, and I don't know of any shows you've done. You'll have to come to see me and let me get a sense of you before we go any further in this. So Larry came to New York. He was a very charming guy. Ralph Gibson, another very charming guy. And before Larry left, Ralph introduced him to his dealer, Leo Castelli. And you would have thought, anyone would have thought, seeing Larry up until this point, that this would not be a strong, fast friendship. Because Leo was a very urbane, elegant guy. He spoke five languages. And Larry was clearly a hustler. He was a tough, aggressive guy. Leo loved him. He actually wished that he had been more like Larry. And Larry, of course, wished he'd been more like Leo. So they actually, they became fast friends. They didn't become dealers of the same kind, if you will. There's primary art and there's secondary art. And Leo almost exclusively sold the primary art of his artists. I mean, he signed up these artists. One of the things, by the way, he did, which is very important in terms of understanding dealers and how they work and how this whole business has changed, is that he would give artists who needed money a stipend every month or so. And it's actually what enabled many of them to live until they earned enough that they could, from their work, that they could do without the stipend. I remember Frank Stella told me that he was on his stipend until 1969, which is to say he never made a profit until then. Anyway, there was that. And also, Leo was a very very wise businessman. He had different gallerists around the world go in with him on representing art, and as a result, they'd only get half the commission, but they'd sell more art. So that was kind of genius in the art dealer world. That was a new approach. So Larry, on the other hand, was a secondary dealer. He was a guy who would come to your house, see that you had a painting on the wall that had some value on it, and know that there was someone else who was looking for that guy on the wall, and would start calling each side. You know, the guy who owned the work would have had no thought that he was about to sell that work. He and yet here was Larry Gagosian just boom, 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 calling sometimes like 15, 20 times a day until each side sort of capitulated. And this one sold and that one bought, and Larry made a profit. The other thing is that Larry is, given short shrift a lot. There's a lot of snobism about, I think, in part a class sort of thing. The guy was and is very aggressive. But the fact is that Larry, then and now, had and has a wonderful eye. I think whenever you walk into any of the Gagosian galleries, you're always struck by how compelling the art is. I mean, he's really good. So it was that eye that enabled him to realize the talent that was in this kid, Basquiat. By then, Larry had rented a loft at 420 West Broadway. And that was right across the street from the huge multi-floor compound where Leo Castelli and a number of other big dealers had their galleries. Larry rented this loft, and it was on the fifth floor, and it literally looked down at Larry. And I've always thought there's something sort of like, yeah, one day I will have your space. At any rate, he was put onto this guy, Basquiat, by a very academic dealer named Anina Nosai. And she said, come to this group show. I've got this kid's work. I think you'll like it. Larry was completely bowled over by it. And became, if not Basquiat's formal dealer, someone who was always going down to get more Basquiats from this kid who worked in the sort of a basement studio area of Anina Nosai's gallery. And so that began to change Larry's perspective. He began to make quite a bit more money. He also introduced himself to Cy Newhouse, major publishing magnate. And by the mid-80s, Larry was representing Cy Newhouse at auctions as selling for Newhouse paintings that were $10, $12, $14 million. At the same time, Mary Boone, another fabulously successful dealer of that time, was representing Basquiat. I'll just say a quick word about Mary Boone. She was clever enough as an unknown dealer in the late 70s to rent a tiny little space in that building 420 I was telling you about, 420 West Broadway. She realized something very profound. She didn't have to rent a whole gallery space. All she had to do was have like a little closet by the elevator where everyone went up to the other big galleries. And she was very charming and sexy, and she's a good talker. And people would start wandering into this tiny tiny closet of a place, and before you knew it, she was a major dealer representing, as you probably know, Julian Schnabel, David Sally, Ross Bleckner, Eric Fischel, and others. This is a a story that I that haunts me to this day. Arnie, I told you, didn't have a sort of consistent group of coterie of artists, if you will. One of the ones that he most valued was a painter named Agnes Martin, who did these fabulous abstract paintings that sort of look grid-like. And from a pretty early time, maybe the 70s, Arnie knew just how good Agnes was, and he did anything he could to get her to do more stuff, more art. So when she would call him and say, okay, I'm done, you can come out now, that meant getting on a plane and going to New Mexico, where Agnes lived alone. She was kind of crazy, lived alone in an adobe compound in northern Mexico, and they would talk about art, and they would play Beethoven, and then there would come a time when Agnes would say, all right, Arnie, show me your favorites, and he would go over, and there would be, you know, maybe eight of these paintings against the wall, or leaning against the wall on the floor, and he knew it was coming, but he had to do it. He would say, all right, I like that one, and that one, and that one, and then Agnes would give him the knife, and she'd say, go ahead, destroy the others. And that's what he would have to do. As her dealer, that's what she wanted. He would destroy her other paintings. So you can argue that both ways. I mean, the fact is many great paintings were probably lost, but maybe the very best are still with us. That is Larry, that's David Geffen, and that's, of course, Leo Castelli, on David Geffen's boat. What happened at the end of the 80s is that a huge recession hit, hit the art world. And Larry has often said that David Geffen was almost the only thing that kept him from destitution, because whenever David Geffen came into Larry's gallery, Larry knew that he'd be able to pay the rent that month. They were all friends, so the 90s. I'm going to get up to that, and then I'm going to make some points about what's actually happened in this market. The 90s were an interesting time. There were people who will tell you that they weren't that fecund for art. That there were a handful of good artists. I don't think so. I think a lot of interesting things are going on. Certainly a lot of interesting things are going on among the dealers, because not only did these two guys survive the recession, but others came along. And one of my favorites is David Zwirner, who was indeed the son of a sort of wealthy gallerist himself. And he only wanted primary artists. He was determined to not represent any secondary. Secondary was seen as sort of downscale somehow. So he became a well-known dealer strictly by doing primary art. By the way, I should say that Larry, despite outwardly professing no interest in representing primary art, he really did want at least one primary artist. And he decided that the one he could get was Cy Twombly. Cy Twombly, who, as many of you may know, does, you know, I won't call it scribble art, but yes, I will. I'll call it scribble art. Very elegant, fascinating, unique art. He had been severely criticized by art critics back in New York, and he had left and gone to live in Italy, and was kind of out of the art scene. Larry was clever enough to recognize that he was enormously talented and one of the few enormously talented artists who, in fact, did not have a dealer, at least not a dealer for everywhere. So he went to see Twombly, and Twombly heard him out for a while, and Larry realized that he was not getting through to this guy. He was just sitting there. You could just, you know, Larry was a salesman. He could tell he was not making his sale. And finally he said, come on, Cy, give the Armenian a chance. And Twombly cracked up, and they became fast friends, and Twombly remained his artist until the end. So at any rate, that is, by the way, Cy Twombly, a wonderful picture. That's the way they lived. I'm going to skip over some of these because I don't think I have time. And I don't want to stop without giving you a little sense of how things have changed and maybe a little indication of where we are now. It was in 1999 that that Leo Castelli died. And I think that while you can choose any arbitrary moment in that general time, it's as good a moment as any to say that this was sort of when the art world became the art market. Already you could see that some dealers were getting much larger than others. And you couldn't tell it at that time, but you would soon be able to see that there were four in particular who were really bigger than everyone. And one of them was Arnie Glemser, and one of them was Larry Gagosian, and one of them was David Zwirner, whom I've mentioned, and the fourth was Ian Wirth, who is Swiss and basically came to the game with an enormous amount of money from his wife's family. And he's a fascinating story on his own, but I'll just leave him out now because what I want to say is that these became the four mega dealers as they're now known. And in my 2-3 years of working on this book, that phrase, that concept just sort of began to emerge, at least it did for me. And now you can't see an art story without art journalism without the mention of the mega dealers. They have all just built these castles down in Chelsea, a couple of which are not yet done. Pace just opened its huge place last fall. You know, there's a lot of controversy about this. I mean, it's kind of looking more and more like any other industry in capitalism, whereby, you know, the biggest guys are the last one standing, and the others get sort of brushed to the margins. Now, there are a lot of things that account for that over these last 20 years, besides just the ambition of those particular dealers, which is certainly a factor. One is the increased number of art fairs, the fact that dealers now feel obligated to take their artists' work not just to one or two art fairs, but to maybe 24 in the course of a year around Europe and everywhere else. And these fairs can be lucrative, but they can also lose the dealer a lot of money if he doesn't sell the art that's in his booth. So that's a tricky business. Another is the extent to which auction houses have become involved. There was a time when auction houses just represented the art of dead artists. You know that they didn't represent living artists. They certainly didn't represent young, hot, living artists. And yet, as the art market began to to propel itself in the early OOs, the auction houses became very aggressive, and they, they could, in some ways, do exactly what the dealers were doing. I mean, we all think of auctions as, you know, the hammer on the on the gavel and auctions happening right there. But auction houses also do private sales, and they could threaten and did threaten the dealers in that regard. There's another factor which can't be denied, and that is the incredible proliferation of billionaires. We've heard a lot about billionaires in the last 24 hours in politics, but you know, billionaires in the art world have changed everything. There were about 200 of them in 1987. Now there are about 2,000 of them. You know, once they've bought their house and their yacht and their plane, you know, what's left but art? And truly, they have embraced art buying to an extent which changes everything. And one of the things that it changes most dramatically is the challenge it presents for small and emerging galleries. You know, we talked about the mega dealers. Okay, great. But the small and emerging galleries have always been essential to this whole process of cultivating new artists and giving them a chance to grow and giving the gallery, the small gallery, a chance to grow with them. There's some very dramatic stories that I came across through the book about how a big dealer, one of these megas, can become aware of an artist who's starting to stir a lot of talk, just come in and swoop them up. And everybody's happy, except, of course, the small gallery that has lost its, you know, new star artist. So that, too, is problematic. I got interested as a sort of, I don't know, corollary of this, private museums, a fascinating aspect to it, too much to go into here, but it has a huge effect on the art market, because if you're a billionaire and you've decided to build your own, you know, museum like Glenstone, let's say, in Potomac, Maryland, outside of Washington, D.C., you have enormous power in the art world. You can say, you know, I've got 12 of these works by this artist, and I think you should give them a show, and I'll underwrite the show. And so the process, the business that gets done between private museums and public museums, between galleries and museums, is all a bit murky. If you get a dealer after a couple glasses of wine, you know, he'll admit, yes, it's true. You know, we have to give museums that money, or, you know, they're not going to be able to afford the show that we want them to give our artists. And so that's part of the business. It's part of what's made things complicated. I'm going to just end with a story that is one of my favorites from the book, and it gives you a little sense of where things are at. One of my favorite dealers is a guy named Gavin Brown. He's English. He's a very ornery guy, but I don't care, because he's really good copy. So when I finally interviewed him, I knew that what I was going to ask him about. I was going to ask him about the hole. The hole is something that was created one day while Gavin Brown was out to lunch. He has a friend, an artist, whose name is Urs Fischer. Is it Urs Fischer? Urs Fischer. And this guy had come into Gavin's gallery when Gavin was gone with a team of jackhammers and just blasted away and created this huge deep hole in the middle of the gallery floor. Gavin came back. Someone else might have been a little upset. Gavin totally understood. He was fascinated. And so they were very happy about this, and then they sold the hole. They sold the hole to a guy named Peter Brandt, who is a major collector up in Connecticut. And I said, but Gavin, how did you get the hole from your gallery up to Connecticut? And he said, oh, we didn't. No, Peter just dug another hole out in Connecticut. I said, really? Doesn't that sound a little crazy? And he said, you know, it does. It is a little crazy. But you have to be a little crazy to be in this business. You know, Peter's a little crazy. Urs Fischer's a little crazy. And I'm a little crazy, too. And you either, like, stay on that train or you just get off. Anyway, thank you. I'm going to stop here. I wish I had time for more. Many, many things that I put down which I was going to share with you, but I think you all need to have dinner. Yes, of course. I would be delighted to. Let me just see, by the way, what I. Oh, that's Iwan Wirth, the fourth of the mega dealers. That goes in with a guy named Joe Bradley that he poached from the Canada Gallery, a little gallery. That's Gavin Brown of the hole. Okay? That's his hole. I'll stop there with that. Anyway, anyone? Yes, sir. Well, with the art book, which I guess is more, well, let me focus on the art book. I knew that the people I most wanted to talk to would not talk to me initially. That is, the four mega dealers. They're very self-important. You know, Larry Gagosian's not going to talk to me. I was not established as an arts writer. He wouldn't have talked to me even if I was. But I did what any journalist does in that situation. You just climb up the food tree. Or the food chain, I should say. I had a couple friends in Sag Harbor who are artists. Eric Fischel is one, and his wife, April Gornick, and they're very sweet people. And Eric knows the whole art scene. And I invited him over for dinner and just said, I want to try to do this book. I don't really know what I'm doing. I'm just interested in this whole craziness with the prices, the market, and how it all happened. Who should I talk to? And he said, well, talk to my my dealer in London, Victoria Moreau. She'll talk to you. So my wife and I went over to London. We walked into this gallery, and it was an amazing gallery. It had this sort of pond in the back, and the pond was filled with these big silver balls. And we, like idiots, said to Victoria, that's really great. Who did that? And she said, oh, it's this Japanese painter who's having quite a revival. His name is Yayoi Kusama. And I said, oh, okay. We walked up the stairs. There was another painting by the same artist, you know. Yes, that was also Kusama. Well, let me just tell you how stupid that is, okay? She's the best-known artist in the world. The idea that I was setting out on a book and I didn't know Kusama is so ridiculous. And she couldn't have been, I mean, Victoria was very nice about it. She put me in touch with Gavin Brown. Anyway, what began to happen was a chain of one and then another. And what you do is you write a letter to the next one and you say, oh, I'm doing this book. And I've interviewed so far, and I'd like to interview you too. And everybody wants to be in the cool group, right? So once you've interviewed some people who are pretty well known, you've been lucky. I got lucky with Eric, you know. Then the others all want to be part of it. And believe it or not, that's how I got right up to Larry Gagosian. I had interviewed the other three mega dealers, and I wrote and got in touch with them. I said, you know, this book is going to go to print. Their voices will all be in it. I'd like you to be part of it too. And he said, well, come in and we'll talk about it. So I came into his office right down the street here. We talked for a while. At one point he said, you're not recording this, are you? I said, no, I'm just listening to you, you know. And at the end he said, gave me a kind of cocked an eye and said, you don't actually need me to do this, do you? And I said, you're right, I don't. There are actually a lot of articles about you from like 30 years ago, which are actually very interesting, and there's a lot of stuff in there. I could do it without you. He said, in that case, I'll talk. So anyway. yes, I mean, I would say that Larry is, if not the overarching reason that I did this book, he certainly is prominent and was from the beginning in my mind, because he's a fascinating guy. I forgot to mention, I'm sure you all know, that he's gone from one gallery to two to 16 galleries around the world. He is uniquely at the top of the pyramid. And I had gave some sort of sneaky serious thought to doing just an out-and-out biography of Gagosian. I think it would have been really hard, because I think if I'd approached him that way, like, hey, I'm doing a biography of you, whether you like it or not, he would have shut every door he could. And there are a lot of people who would have shut their doors if he told them to. And it's just, why have all that sort of pressure and anxiety? Why just not go in a totally different way and say, I'm an historian, essentially. I'm doing a history of how the contemporary art market evolved, your field. I just want to know how it happened. And with that, virtually everybody talked. They love talking about that. Anybody else? Yes.
You mentioned the number of billionaires.
Yeah.
287 of 2000.
Right.
And is this U.S. or?
No, I think that's global, actually.
Well, there's also a rise in millionaires, obviously.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it has. I mean, we didn't get to this, but, you know, the whole thing of art advisors or, you know, financial consultants. Don Marin, the recently deceased collector whose work is now going to be sold, he took a very financial sort of pragmatic view of this. I mean, he loved the art he collected, but he, you know, he really set out to learn all he could so that he was making smart buys and making a profit. And he did it, by and large, very well. He was a great collector. He, you know, given hundreds of works to the MoMA. But, you know, most people aren't that lucky. And you know, for ordinary people like us to decide we're going to be art collectors, you really have to kind of be in it for the, just the sheer pleasure of it and not expect to make anything back. It reminds me of a quote from Jerry Verisaltz. Jerry Saltz, who's a wonderful art critic for New York Magazine, and he said, "You know, the fact is, most contemporary art is crap." He said, "He said only about 15% is any good. Is going to last." And you know, he said, "If only we knew which 15% it was, we could make a fortune. But the trouble is, what I think is great, you don't. And, you know, forever it will be thus." And then some people get lucky. I have a relative who's a doctor who has collected contemporary art for 30 years, and he's made an enormous fortune, with far more than his medical profession, because he got... You know, Ellsworth Kelly, he thought, sounds good, looks promising. George Kondo, I mean, these are names which in the last 30 years have really emerged. And so you can do it, but don't count on it. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I know that you were at one point, or maybe still, working on a documentary on the same subject.
Yeah. I think that was so outrageous. There are various reasons why I would say that's a blip. now, of course, there's art forgery.
Make sure everyone knows what that is.
Yes, one of the things that makes that very unlikely to happen again is the forger himself, the Chinese guy, who was able to do, you know, paintings that really passed for Rothkos and Pollocks and de Koonings, so much so that, you know, she could display them at at art fairs, like at the, you know, Armory down here. And it'd be a little sort of whispering, like, "Gee, what's the provenance on that one?" But they looked very good. It's very hard to find someone. I think it'd be fascinating to find this guy. You know, it's a pity he left the country again. He should come back and just do this for sport and just acknowledge that he's doing fakes. But they were really, really good. So anyway, that was difficult. I think the idea that these 40 or 50 or more paintings by all those masters of the post-war period could all have no provenance was insane. And it just... you know, it's hard to believe that the art market would make that mistake again anytime soon. That said, there's art crime. I only deal with it a little bit at the end because who knows, really? You know, is there a lot of money laundering that goes on? Unquestionably. But, you know, no one seems able to track it. Anyway, yes. Yes. Right. Well, authentication is a fascinating issue. you know, if you've bought a Warhol, used to be you would go to the Warhol Authentication Board and they would determine that your work was authentic. But there were some very interesting lawsuits that arose, and the problem was that the authentication board might be throwing its weight around for its own political reasons, but it also might be that they could look at the piece you just bought from a garage or something, and they could see why it was inauthentic. But if they told you, then you would know too. You know, they wanted to preserve their power and basically their judgment, and keep other fakers from doing just that sort of painting that would have that little giveaway description. So anyway, so that's one aspect, and the other aspect is that if you buy a Warhol and it's been authenticated, but then the authentication board changes its mind because some other works have come in, you might go to court and say, hey, I pay a lot of money for this. And so the authentication boards found themselves mired in lawsuits. Keith Haring, anyway, others. And it's very difficult now to find a board that will authenticate. I think that the dealers kind of have taken that role, but how much legal liability they accept, I don't know. Yes?
How do women dealers fare in this period of
harvest? Oh, thank you for bringing that up. They fare really well. And women in contemporary art is a long and happy story, starting with Paula Cooper, that very attractive woman who was and is still sort of the doyen of minimalist art. She had the first gallery in Soho in 1968. She just celebrated her 50th birthday, I think. Not birthday, 50th year in business. And then Ileana Sonnabend, who was Leo Castelli's wife, and many would say had a better eye than he. She was very active as a dealer after they got divorced for years. I can think of others, but one I'll just tell because it's sort of an interesting story. Lisa Spellman is a wonderful dealer who really by accident moved to Chelsea, as other dealers were doing in the 90s, and bought a taxi garage, you know, one of those little one-story taxi garages down there by the river. And some big developer came along and wanted to build a big building that would take up the entire corner. And so he basically bought her taxi garage out for tens of millions of dollars. And not only that, but he constructed one corner of his huge edifice to be a gallery for her. So, you know, she's just a happy woman. And anyway, there are a lot of other really interesting women dealers. Marion Boesky is one. Another time we'll talk about that. Yes?
Well, you kind of alluded to some of this before, but I'm just curious on your thoughts of, you know, like the contemporary art market and world in, let's say, the next generation, given, and some people have mentioned these things, A, the forgery, you know, the forgery and the lack of authentication. But there's something else that people have mentioned, which is, I don't really hear a lot of, like, sort of scuffing about this particular kind of art. Like, in other words, I hear many say, anyone could do that. I'm not saying that's true.
It was ever thus. Yeah.
So, you know, like, there are a lot out there who say, like, this is just a trend, it's kind of a bubble, generation, people aren't really going to like this kind of art. What are your thoughts on that?
I don't pay too much attention to people who sort of say my 5-year-old could have done that. Although there is one guy that you could almost think that way about. And I had a picture of him up there. I said he was standing there with Larry Gagosian. Joe Bradley is actually a very successful Gagosian artist these days, but he started by doing stick figures. I mean, he literally just did stick figures on the canvas, and then you put the canvas down on the dirty ground and sort of rub it around. And it was so outrageously kind of unsophisticated that people started talking about it when the little gallery had a show of it. And the more they talked about it, the more Gavin Brown thought, God, if everyone's talking about it, maybe there's something to it. So he poached this guy from a little thing called Canada Gallery. And then Gagosian had the same reaction. He thought, wow, everybody's talking about this guy, Joe Bradley. I better poach him. So anyway, there are artists whose work does make you think that your five-year-old could have done it. Mostly, that's not true. And it's really more about us needing to acclimate ourselves to a kind of look, a sensibility, a kind of art that we've never seen before. I just walked yesterday down to Gagosian to see these paintings by this guy, David Reed, and totally brand new to me. Maybe he's been around for a while, but he just does these sort of fascinating brush strokes on big canvas, and you might say that your five-year-old could do that, except not really, because it's very elegant, and the more you look at it, the more complex it is. So I think there'll be plenty of more complex art. I'm not worried about running out of it. Yes?
I'd like to know where you assign the role of the art critic, especially in the decline of publications.
Right.
What we might call the digital.
Sure. No, but actually, as you say, that one thing that I did notice in my reporting is that these dealers are huge engines of publicity. And every few months, they will have a big gathering to announce their latest upcoming shows. And I've noticed that they hire all these art writers to write the copy, the essays or whatever. And
the catalog
essay or whatever might accompany the gathering, the press gathering, but right, yes. Well, it's really the critics. I mean, the critics are being hired to do these essays, and really, it seems to me, having their own independence, somewhat shanghaied. Anyway, but another answer to your question is that. Indeed, there are far fewer critics. Except the galleries. That's the funny thing. Instagram is a factor. I mentioned Jerry Saltz. He's a terrific old world art critic, and that he's, you know, always writing fascinating, provocative reviews. But there aren't many. I mean, you know. I mean, remember Clement Greenberg and how important his criticism was. It could change the entire art world overnight. We don't have that. Anyway.
Thank you. Will you sign books?
Sure, happy to. Thank you.